from the Arkansas line and about 7 or 8 miles from where the three states of Texas, Arkansas, and Louisiana come together. Go ahead.
So I didn't hear anything else, so I just came straight back down here. So I've had quite a big day here today. First after I spoke with you this morning, I was on the dozer for about, at least 3 hours, cutting this water race. So I spent some time doing that. I'm cutting it along a fence line and it's covered up with Manuka native scrub at the moment. So I've been bulldozing out all the scrub for a start and then cut the race. So I spent 3 hours at that, and Margaret came to get me because the telephone company, Telecom, are here putting in the permanent telephone line. So, as luck would have it, they ran through a water line, cut a water line. So I had to come back and fix that. That took me an hour or so to fix. And since then, I've been doing some oiling on the exterior of the house.
Now, I tell you what, let me turn the beam around.
Let me get my chart
down here and see which way. I don't have one of those automated rotors, and I can just pop it in there. I do have to turn it. Now let me turn it around. Okay, I see about where to turn it now. Let me turn the beam, if you will, and see if that'll help, Alan, okay?
Either at Gatwick or somewhere around sort of Victoria Coach Station for about 21 days hire, Mel. An escort for hire for about 21 days that I could pick up, say, on the 1st of May at either Gatwick or somewhere near Victoria Coach Station, Mel, break.
Oh, that's simple, isn't it? That's simple. That's simple. I can organise that by a travel agent or something here, Roy. I don't know how you do it. Perhaps you need your card number or something. I think they would do it with your car. Oh, it's simple, Roy. That can be easily be arranged.
Yeah, okay, Mel, I was thinking.
Yeah, thank you for asking. Sorry about that, buddy.
There's one or two courses in each one, and so we're not really experts. We know in general what happens, and we can figure out problems and go to the books and find things, but you're not really an expert in any one of those fields. And in effect, they're training us to know what kind of questions to ask of the specialist and what kind of information you want from the accounting staff, and know what's realistic. So what we do is take and the basic requirement is 12 courses, and then the extra 8 for the people without the immediate background. So a thesis would be almost suicide. I don't know that anyone has ever finished one of those successfully in this area, or at least, not in a reasonable amount of time. I think about 3/4 of our students are working and attending part-time, and I kind of went from that majority into the minority of full-time ones, and it's kind of interesting because, I'm now with a whole group of people, the ones that went full-time and for a couple years and are finishing up, and the ones that have been going part-time for 5 years that are finishing up. So my classes this semester is I'm really taking extra classes and rapidly advancing as a new group of people to be involved with. That's really kind of an interesting thing that I noticed, that people I used to be familiar with, I've passed them and I don't see them anymore in the classes. Interesting. I work with a professor in production operations management that a lot of the full-time students have what's called a graduate assistantship. You work with a professor, helping him with his classroom work and papers, and this guy writes articles for publication, and I get to read and edit those and discuss the parts that I don't understand that I think he should rewrite. A lot of the professors are right at a level that of their own, and really the goal, especially in something that's practically oriented, is to write in a level a manager with some experience would understand. So I always try to get him to have a very good introduction that explains the entire article in very simple terms, and make sure that all unusual terms are defined throughout the article and it flows well. So that's one of the things with my job that I am really enjoying, is that editing process and getting to get in a lot more details than I did when I took the course in that area. Your mention of architecture brings to mind my sister. She's was an architectural student and moved to Canada and is trying to finish up on her thesis. I'm changing topics and having indecision, but she'll get that one done eventually. She's in architecture, and I think that's a difficult field because, the kind of jobs that you can get initially are more drafting-type jobs. She found it was very difficult because moving to a foreign country and learning how to speak French, and the French that she learned was classroom French, and they have more French dialects, and the people in Quebec speak a dialect, and it was like a new type of French she had to learn, plus all the architectural terms in France. It was very difficult transition. So it's interesting that you mentioned architecture. She had just wrote me a letter this week, and I know what she's doing because she's procrastinating her work. She didn't say anything at all about her schoolwork that needed to be done, just things that they had done and what was happening around the city. Back to you for another one. What is it, 2 o'clock? I can't stay up too much longer because in 4 hours, 3.5 hours, my wife will get up, and in about 4 hours, 4.5 hours, the kids will be getting up, and I'm supposed to be up and watching them.
And manufacturing in Sweden and unions in Yugoslavia. And I don't know, that's just an advantage. To me, it's a normal type of thing. What do you
think? Absolutely. Fantastic signal, especially not with an amplifier. You're a good 20 over. Got a Kenwood 430. And you're bumping the needle, a good 20 over. And maybe a little over that sometime. So the 930, you said you rang a 930. You didn't say anything else on the tail end of it. You just said 930, so I presume that is all you've got. Well, that certainly speaks for a rhombic antenna, so you must be getting a good bit of gain out of that. Number one, it must be pointed in this direction, and number two, it must have 8 or 10 dB gain at least, because you're right up there with someone that has a great big amplifier. And okay, I'm breaking. No problem, man. We all knew that. I do it myself. I make it a point just like you do. It's like, hey, is the frequency in use? And if some voice pops back and says, yes, it is, I say, thank you, and scoot on off someplace else. So that's real easy to do. Lots of time on a short skip around here. Maybe a W-2 is working another W-4, a couple hundred miles, and I don't hear him at all. And then I pop in there, and at W-2 or whatever, they'll say, yeah, it sure is in use. So that takes care of that real quick. Well, let's see. I think we told you the equipment, the Kenwood 430. I do have an amplifier, about LO12, about 700 watts to a tri-band beam. And I'm honest to goodness, I don't think this tri-band, I think you're and I want to turn it back on. It's about 700 watts there, Ray. Go ahead.
Yeah, fine, Jim. Not a beautiful copy. When you switched off your slow about 15 to 20, I didn't see all that much difference in it, really, but just the audio dropped back a wee bit, but when you put the amplifier back on, it suddenly jumped up there again. Real good. That beam is doing a great job down here. This antenna's 90 feet up in the air, Jim, and it's 350 foot of length. I think it's about 5 or 6 wavelengths on this band, and it has beamed on 50 degrees, which is up through Los Angeles, I think, but it does appear to work quite well. We've got 1,400 feet of open wire feed line away to the antenna, and it comes back into a tuner here, and it seems to go quite well on this band, and also 10, 15, and 40 meters, but I don't need to run an amplifier with it, Jim. Just 100 watts out seems to do the trick there, buddy, but that's what's coming up your way, but your signal here is just as good. It's really, really booming and fine on your QTH here in Georgia. Real good. And my QTH here is Hastings on a low Sierra Tango, India, Norway, Gulf, Sierra, and we're about halfway up the eastern coast of the Northern Ireland of ZL. W4IEN.
Yeah, a real fine sentence there, Ray. Stand by. Al, I don't know whether my boat is going to cooperate with me working and talking somewhere at this wee hour of the morning over here. Just the fun over there. I play with the antenna a little bit. I switched over here to the, this is the long wire antenna now. This is the center fed long wire. I switched back and forth on the other ZL a few minutes ago. And
I'm someplace on the side of the lake. And after the sauna, I jumped into the lake. And that was in Hermanlina, Greg.
Just completed a new antenna system. It is a six element cubical
D's, and then I would easily be convinced to go on for a PhD degree. Yeah, we have many, many more things to talk about because, you know, it's interesting to use American books, and sometimes I feel guilty because we really encourage foreign students in our program, and we've got quite a few, and I'm just thinking it must be so difficult for them to translate these concepts to what they've seen, to bring them back. You know, I don't know if they always apply to the culture, the kind of things that we're taught. And I think some of the best presentations we've had is from the foreign students that, for instance, in marketing last semester, each foreign student gave us a brief lecture on some aspect of marketing in their country. The guy from Nigeria talked about the open air market and how the prices change during the course of the day as different things are available or not available, and the bargaining process that goes on. And the guy from Hong Kong told about how they were laissez-faire and very little government intervention. And it was... Yeah, that's a good thing. So it was really curious that you mentioned using American books, you know, and not to say that they're the answer or the right way to approach it. You know, they don't always work in our situation, that's for sure. Okay, I need to go to bed. It won't be long before I have to get up. But I do hope we can talk again before too long here.
And little technical correspondence in this month's QST magazine, and I
knew the author. We had done contests together and wrote him off a page of questions. And he's going to send me a floppy disk with some design formulas on it. Yeah, hopefully that'll arrive soon so I can play with it over the vacation holiday. Give me something unusual to do. You know, I'll go in my professor's office and pull up these programs or antenna designs, and I'll just be totally baffled that, you know, I'm involved in that kind of thing. I'm an XG also, XG5ATU. I spent some time between high school and college over around London, and that's really what got me interested in a lot of DXing and foreign type things, and we'll talk about that sometime later, Bob. I guess
sounded as good as you do there. I had tried calling stations and pilots without turning the amplifier on, and I never get them. I just never get them. Of course, I'm sure everyone else in the pilot has the amplifier on and so forth, but I know from experience that if I hear any kind of pileup at all, if I want to work the station, I better turn the amplifier on, because if I don't, I don't stand a chance then. So whatever, I guess whatever conclusion you come up with, it's like the doctor that gave the patient some kind of medication that had absolutely nothing in it, and the patient was convinced it was good medication, it would help him. So maybe we're the same way on the antenna. I always like Thalam. I have a Thalam in this vein, and I just believe it helps it, and balance signal, balance line there works better. But I hear so many fellas that do things otherwise, and they still come out with a real good signal. So it's just hard to figure out. Well, Ray, thank you for the call. I don't have a whole lot more on this end, but we'll flip it back out there to you. And you've had an outstanding signal here, the old whole QSO.
Scrabble at all. Now, you're booming in here. I was quite surprised at your comments also, the difference between the long wire and the beam switching back and forth, but I really couldn't see much in it here. And I really would have expected a bit of a drop back in your audio quality. here, but nothing whatsoever. You're just thrashing me at 20 over 9 on the long wire and a wee bit stronger on the beam, but nothing to write home about. Beautiful copy. Okay, Jim, thank you very much for this call from Georgia. We'll look for you on the band some other time. Very good morning to you. Good evening from ZL. Our time here in Hastings is 8:15 p.m. on Thursday evening. Bye-bye, Jim, and thanks very much.
Roger, real fine, but let me ask you real quick before you get away. I'd forgotten about that. A few minutes ago, the other fellow I was calling to there said he noticed, he thought he noticed some difference in my audio quality when I switched from the beam to long wire. Did you notice anything like that?
No, negative, Jim. The audio quality of the long wire is extremely good. The only thing I noticed was the beam was a little bit stronger, S meter reading, but nothing, you know, your voice quality was still very, very strong, about the same as the beam. QSL?
Yeah, okay, fine, but I couldn't see any difference why the audio response would be any difference at all between the two of them, but I'm sure if he commented on it, he was noticing something there, and the SWR is reflective power just sitting on zero on both of them here, so the transmitter should see the same thing no matter which one it was looking into. So thank you much. Enjoy the QSO. The best of good luck to you out there.
There are many reasons, just the one reason. Something else that came out was that back when the Dan-Conti Act, we got on this, went through, there was one provision of that thing that was astounding how they got that through, but the Democratic Congress, in order to let that thing go through, they had to enter this in there because of the pressure of the Transportation Union, which was a big one at that time and powerful. They were the only ones that were allowed with this particular act that they could perform, and that was a secondary boycott. The Transportation Union was the only one that legally could have a secondary boycott. Now that you know what that is, like they could, like what's going to be tried here on this Eastern Airlines strike, and that is picking all the corner Amtrak and all the transportation to the East Coast and just freeze it down. Make the public demand that something be done, give them what they want, see. But, however, the Congress at that time was just shaking in their boots because of the power of the union. Well, that has diminished considerably in the past 10 or 15 years. And there was back there that we have...
All the snow that we have on the ground should be melting in the next... probably in the next 2 days or so, it should all be gone. In fact, the 11 inches of snow that we received on Sunday night...
best to you and yours back there, Ed.
5 at 10 over 9, barefoot, so very good. Just before you go, Peter, how does my signal compare with my brother, over?
And Beverly Hills. And Jim is coming up here fantastically well tonight, averaging 10 over 9. Outstanding signal. Propagation is excellent. And I've been up to Edinburgh, Jim, and I was just thinking of the names of some of the castles in the Edinburgh area. I'm trying to think, and I don't mean castles, maybe they're abbeys. I think they're abbeys, though I think there's a castle called Stirling Castle, and then I've been to Melrose Abbey and Dryborough, so you might tell me about that, Jim. Refresh my memory on that. I just think of the name of Stirling Castle, Melrose Abbey, and Dryborough Abbey.
I don't even bother looking at them. Bob, you're a couple of years older than my son, who's now living in New York.
But I used to go to Europe every year because he was studying in France at the Sorbonne. But he's back in New York now and making scripts for television. So just take good care of your health, because when you got that, Bob, you're a rich man. You don't realize it. Money isn't everything, although it helps, but the health is the most important thing. So you have a good sleep and a good day and good health for the rest of the year. And I hope to talk to you. I leave here in May, and I'll be in North Carolina. I got a condominium there and a 940 and a Terrify 72B's amplifier and a five-element Wilson rotatable tower with the motor on the base. at the base of the pipe, tip over and winch it up. So the whole tower turns, Bob. So I hope if I don't talk to you before I leave, I hope to talk to you from North Carolina. Hendersonville, North Carolina. Go ahead.
I've got two. I've got one of our graduates here. I've got a student from Spain now. He's taking some preliminary courses right now, but he's pretty good. He just got himself a car. He bought himself a 1975 Toyota for $1,500, and he's absolutely overwhelmed. He said he never thought he'd have a car like that for that price. He got one. The guy put a new motor in, and it's in excellent condition, and redone the, I think he rebuilt the motor and all of that. So he is really excited. But my other student, he's working for us. He's on an assistantship, and he's an interesting fellow. He told me yesterday that he had himself another job. He was working at a pit shop not too far away from here. And I said, the assistants don't normally take jobs like that. And he said, well, I'm only working one day a week. And I asked him, do you need the money? I mean, you're making, although it's not really great, you've got an assistantship here. And he said, well, I really don't need the money, but I just felt like I wanted to. And so I thought about it for a day or so, and I told him yesterday that he wouldn't be able to work at the pit shop because he's going to be neglecting his duties here. And so he seemed a little disappointed. So I found out, I'm not sure exactly what the reason is, but it might have something to do with this story. He was telling one of the other guys that he was down at the pit shop, and this local stripper came in with her boa constrictor, and so she had it wrapped around her neck there, and he was all excited about this this lady. And I'm just wondering if his job at the pit shop, which is not too far away from the strip joint, has anything to do with him willing to work down there. I can.
I hope any ZLs listening don't get insulted, but I've never been outside the airport, and we were hoping on this, on our next trip, to be able to spend some time there, but it is unfortunate because of Dad's situation that we once again can't tour around New Zealand. I think some future trip, Harry, we'd like to spend a week going around New Zealand at least, because we've heard so much about it, and it looks beautiful from the air. So, okay, there's... that's about it, I think. I don't know what else we've got to talk about here, but hey, we've got everything sorted out, and the little case is all ready with a tag on it, and shouldn't be any problems there. If the pilot of the car doesn't mind, I might put the mag mount on the roof and fire it up on your frequency, Harry. So you might, if you leave it on Saturday, you might hear me call from... as soon as we get in range, Harry, on 146875, I think you said it was. We may come on the air from there. And back to you there, Harry. It's about minus 12 here this morning, Harry. Overcast. Looks like you could possibly get some snow, but who cares, Harry? I'm on my way.
On 20 metres, in the mornings here, but they've always been pretty short. And this morning I thought I was going to be able to get on. Maybe I talked to George. I have talked to George one time recently, and we're looking forward to getting over to Charlotte together. And
there's evidently still some stations here that want to gather, and I've lost up the whole detail on them, and I apologize to them for that. So you've got to go to bed, and I think I'm going to get my clothes on, because I haven't even got dressed yet here this morning. So you might give me your comments on my process, and then we'll call it quits. Been a delightful conversation.
I got my ham license, and DeSoto says that in 1936 there were 60,000 hams in the U.S., and the average ham was 24 years of age. I wouldn't guess what the average age is now
of the American ham, the average American ham, but I'll bet you that it's at least, well, I don't know, but I would guess that it might be double that, that figure, maybe up between 45 and 50. Maybe that's just because I've gotten old in the service, but it is a shame with all the inducements they offer you, Ralph, with a complete ham shack at the dorm, and your, well, that's your own rigs at 500, but the 940 with the Henry Linear, and gee, you know, if they do a little work on the antennas, you'd probably be one of the most sought after DX prizes on the Briny.
Even though it's quite south of your area, I see that on a map that says something about, let me see if I can read it out for you. It says Larsen Volcanic National Park. So I guess that's where, more or less, you probably work there in that
area. Matter of fact, about an hour and a half ago, I was watching a program on the Atlanta station, WTVS, Turner Station, and it was an Audubon Society program, and they were giving reports there on how the government over there is picking up and chasing and hunting down all these folks that are doing some illegal hunting, shooting bears and all kinds of deers and stuff, and eagles, and selling them for large profits. Possibly was it one of these guys that was doing the shooting got 15 years of jail. I knew about you getting fines and maybe doing a year or something, but 15 years, my goodness, I mean, some people have gotten less for killing other people, so that's really strange. Does that go on in your area there? Do you folks have to keep an eye on these illegal hunters, and do they usually get that type of a stiff penalty there in California? Back to you there, Tom.
Plus, I didn't get your name. Can you give it to me? Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry about that, Tom. The name is Joe. Joe at Oscar Echo.
Okay, Joe. Yeah. You might have given it to me. I didn't pick it up there. The poaching that's been going on, I don't really know how to answer that. It's kind of transparent, if you know what I mean.
I'm just flat place in the world. A lot of wild game in there, about 300 trout-filled lakes up on top of it. In fact, we're surrounded by mountains just about everywhere here. A rather arid country, though. We're on the west slope of the Colorado Rockies. And the moist air that we get here usually comes from the west, and it's dropped out over in Utah quite a bit before it gets here. We retired, Eric, for about 2 years. We worked in the oil fields in the Rocky Mountains and Oklahoma and Texas for better than, 34 years. And we're greatly enjoying ham radio now. The rig here is a Kenwood 940. And the antenna is a Telrex tri-bander. For quite a few years over in eastern Colorado, where we would, it wasn't uncommon to get 75 and 80 mile an hour winds. At least about once every year. And 40 and 50 mile winds were pretty common every year.
One quarter inch gap, I think he referred to it as, or a half-inch spark gap, was only good for 5 miles of coverage. And then a guy running a quarter KW BMW could work 100 miles, and the guys running 1 kW spark gap could operate over 400 to 500 miles. So when Hiram Percy Maxim, who established and created and founded the ARRL, organized this relay league, he had to tie guys together that could only communicate 5 to 10 miles in some instances. And there's just fascinating accounts in there of these transatlantic messages that were sent, and the hams place in World War One, and how they had, many of them had better equipment than the military. As a matter of fact, most of them did, who were at all well-to-do, and the government apparently bought it. And I recall that when World War II started, that the government bought some of the better ham gear that was available. So it didn't sound to me like we had made an awful lot of progress. Maybe I didn't mention to you, but I was communications officer in the Army Air Force for 4 years. I think, I was telling that to the young man over in Hawaii. But, boy, when I had a ham available to me, he was almost automatically a tech sergeant. And I had two hams with me at one ferrying group I was at, and they just set up schools to maintain the level of proficiency of the radio operators, and we had 350 to 400 radio operators there at the peak when we were ferrying aircraft all over the world. And those two hams set up the retraining school. We had code equipment where we could impose noise on it to screw it all up, so you had to copy through QRN and QRM and work the code speed up real good, and taught them how to tune up the rigs real well and all that sort of thing. So they're invaluable. They were absolutely invaluable, and every one of them was prized, I know, in World War II, and even more so in World War I. I had a nice chat the other day with a ham in Omaha who had a lot of satellite capability and was a retired Federal Aviation Agency maintenance supervisor on radar and communications equipment. And he's a real nice guy and interesting as could be. And he had all sorts of channel capability with that satellite rig, and I assume they could put one on your ship, and then you'd have live TV in probably 60 different languages. He pointed out that he enjoyed the Discovery Channel, which we have here on our local cable, and he told me that there would be a program they call Great Planes, Great Airplanes, really, and that was on last night at 10 o'clock local time on the Discovery Channel, and they covered the development of the Harrier. That's the, Vertol, or the stall, V-stall, takeoff and landing, the vertical takeoff and landing jet fighter that the Marines use as a standard unit. And man, the development of that thing and all the companies that tried to produce it was really interesting. And they've got one coming up on the B-17, which was an aircraft that I had a great deal of familiarity with. And, of course, we picked up all the newly manufactured airplanes from the West Coast, including eventually B-29s, Lockheed, the first jets, the P-60 Lockheed Shooting Star, and B-25s and C-47s and all of that old World War II prop job fleet. But
We didn't have anything like that in our airplane. That is just fantastic to see a plane just go up vertically and then take off like a stripe in a pie. Anyway, Ralph, we've sure had a nice ride through here, and I've enjoyed it thoroughly. So I hope you have a good trip the rest of the way over to Seattle, and with your signal, you ought to be able to work a lot of guys. I wonder if anybody wants to break us down. I thought I heard something a little while back. Negative. I don't hear anything here, Ralph. Anyway, I think it's about time for me to shut it down, and I guess it's a little bit earlier out there in the briny. I don't know what kind of ship's time you guys observe when you're en route. I never bothered to learn that when I was coming back from India on 31 days on a general class ship. But that was a little much for me. And you know what got me was all those pilots that have been flying the hump over there between India and China, which is absolutely the worst weather in the world. You know, with downdrafts that would go 140 miles an hour and over a few feet, there'd be an updraft going up at about the same rate. And these guys are flying that kind of weather day in and day out over the hump into China. And they got on that ship, and man, in no time at all, they were all turned green. And you know how being seasick, well, maybe you don't, but being seasick is like wanting to be dead. Anyway, that's about the end of it over here, Ralph. I have a couple of things I got to do here, and I might as well chop it now. But we sure have had a nice talk, and I've enjoyed it thoroughly, and I'll look for you tomorrow night, 208.10. How do you like that? This thing has got a resolution now to 10 cycles, but I don't know how good the frequency stability is. You can read more than there really is there, as you know. Anyway.
Yeah, I'll be over in Sydney about the 28th of April, I guess it is, for a few days, not many days, before we go up to the Great Barrier Reef. So it's a compressed schedule, but the best I can do, and never did make it. You know, during the war, I said, geez, I've been out of country 3 years, but gosh, I'd like to go to Australia. I got a billet down there, send me down there. And they said, geez, this guy's cracking up. You better send him back home. Okay, 73.
Especially accompanying. I think accompanying is so much fun if you can. But, you know, finding the right person to, like, you know, it's like dancing with someone, I guess, which I don't do anymore. But, you know, when that person knows what you're going to do and you know what they're going to do, it's very seldom that situation ever happens. That's on location, but of course when you arrange something like you do, like you did for this, that would be fantastic. I sure would love anything like that. That would be fantastic, huh? Anyway, take my address down for further communications, and maybe we can trade something. I can find something here that you might be interested in or something, you know, so that would be great. But you're the guy with all the good stuff. And I'm going to order some of these cordial things, and I see how they come out. You know, I'll see what they are, and then I can tell you, and then maybe I can copy off of them. I mean, I have some Revox machines here, you know, some old A77s, and so that should be okay, or whatever. You know, I mean, at least we can listen, you know, and at least have the darn things, Julian. But this is great. This is an unexpected surprise, Julian. I sure appreciate your time, because I know you're kind of a you're a pretty busy guy there, you know, go here and go there, and you're always on the move there. Yeah, I don't have one. I've collected some Braille slates here. I'm looking for an old metal arithmetic slate. Damn it, I would like to find one of those when I was a kid. The metal ones, not the plastic. I have a wooden one here, a wooden arithmetic slate, but of course I'm terrible at arithmetic. Anyway, my address is P.O. Box 81. Okay? All right. Okay, that's good. Well, you know, Johnny... That's great, Julia. You know, Johnny, of course, had experience because, you know, we grew up together. We used to have all kinds of stories. We used to act out, you know, but I forgot what they are now, but about, you know,
if something was a penny more than something else, it's... wouldn't have flutter, you know, when you played the guitar well, because when you didn't have any money, you know, you bought these things, and the guitar always sounded like it had a bubble in it. You're
thinking, that's fine. I couldn't reel to reel tape recorder. They used to be four track, and then I made the two track out of it. But I have Sony four track machines, and I have all kinds of tracks. Oh wow, yeah, okay. I had a Revox Revox cassette machine a long time ago, but I think they were just getting into the business then. And so yeah, that's fine. So Dolby B would be fine. That's what they have. They don't have a C and everything, you know, and everything in this way. Like my the Budokan has Dolby B, I think. Is that? Yeah. Anyway, just to have something of you would be just great, Joey. I don't know where you're gonna have the machine hooked up into the equipment. Also, it's a direct situation, you know, and. I can give you a kind of a demonstration of the sounds in the thing, and then yeah, I think you might get a kick out of that anyway. Nothing that great musically, and then I can, you know, because it is direct, so whatever. So the cassette is hooked right into the rack, so you just press a button, and it's amazing today what can be done. You know, no more microphones, no more big reel to reel. Well, I mean, you know, you can do that, but I mean, no more big heavy. I have a four channel test cam here, and a big and a 4-8 in and 4-out test cam mixer, and I don't know, it just sits here and you don't know what to do with it anymore. I know, you don't know what to do with the stuff anymore. I use a Hill mixer over at, in my rack, a Hill. That's a 16 channels, and 16 in and 2 out, I guess is that what they call it. And I use that, and I've run out of channels. I mean, I got the, and that's what I use over there, and that's rack mounted. So everything today has got to be rack mounted. I mean, it's a rack mounted. It's a shame, though. I mean, this thing, I mean, here it is, right? We see it, it's sitting here. What are we going to do with all this stuff? Well, Julian, if we need a few bucks, but then you can't even get that much money.
I have reverb units here, and in 1982, I paid $500 at a good price, AKG spring units, $550 a piece. I had seven of them. They ain't worth 7 cents a piece now.
The minute you buy this stuff, it's,
went along, and,
gave me a lot of information and different things, and he's going to send me a nice cassette there of some things that he's done there, some different things that he knew I would like there. So that's fantastic, and we're going to have a little time, make time to communicate. And anyway, so. Does it smell good over there? Does it smell? I mean, what's the chicken? What kind of chicken is that? You know, it's 5:30 in the morning here. Ain't gonna know. W20H ain't gonna get nothing over here. I'll tell you, unless he makes it himself. And I'm not gonna have no hone and beef, man. That stuff was hot.
It's not Kentucky Fried Chicken anyway. That's for sure.
Hey, that's junk. That's junk. It's still good. Got me about an S7 here and this thing. But boy, congratulations. Boy, I'll tell you, what a signal Julian's got into the East Coast here at all times there, Billy Boy. And it's amazing, though, that I can hear Bill and Lee so well with their little antennas.
I leave the processor in there. That helps you with a woodpecker. I wouldn't take it out. But reduce the gain. Reduce the audio gain a little bit, Clive. Into the black, I guess it was Black Ball Tunnel, where they all went, you know, to escape the bombs. And I remember she told me about the airman that brought one of the Zeppelins down off of outside of London there, by the name of Lieutenant Ball, B-A-L-L. I won't remember if you ever remember the story of Lieutenant Ball, over.
Roger. Actually, Lieutenant Ball was one of the top World War One British aces, actually, Lieutenant Ball. I believe that, if I remember rightly, the Zeppelin, like a monument in there. I remember seeing that. I used to have a look around the old cemeteries as well, because quite often you get some very interesting information on the old tombs as well, Harry. You know, I used to like to have a look around some of the old tombs and read what some of the inscriptions were. And I remember there was a bit of a monument in Beckton, I think it was Beckton Cemetery, up the Barking, what used to be called the old Barking Bypass, there was a monument there to some German airmen that were killed in a Zeppelin which crashed in flames quite close to the turn them off there, Harry, back here.
Yeah, that's right, because they use hydrogen.
But I were using hydrogen. My mother said she could see the incendiaries from the plane, and she told me the story about Lieutenant Ball
bringing down that Zeppelin.
I guess they tried to drive it over the sea so it wouldn't fall on any houses, of course, or any populous places, because I think they filled them with hydrogen. They didn't have any non-inflammable gases at the time. I guess we had the helium, and so they would use hydrogen. But I remember telling me about Lieutenant Ball, the English ace there, and she saw the Zeppelins, of course, and that they had to go into the Blackwall Tunnel and some of the underground places to get away from the Zeppelins that were dropping bombs, of course. Well, it's been very interesting. Too bad I can't get together with you, and we could go around Poplar, and you could show me around there, Roy. But I don't suppose that'll ever be. But I would like to go back sometime and go through St. Catherine's house there, and look and see. I was wondering if they would, if they probably wouldn't have any way of locating somebody that was still alive, would they, Roy?
Roger, Harry. Yep, they've got records, of course, of all births and deaths and marriages there, so they could put you onto the actual area where your cousins were married and all, where they've been children have been born to them, whatever. So they could literally put you onto the if your cousin has got children and grandchildren, they would be recorded, and their location would also be recorded, because it all goes into the great record there, Harry. So you could literally trace them through, possibly through their children, and pinpoint them almost exactly from there, Harry. Back to you.
Yeah, if you contacted St. Catherine's house and gave them the information, all you could, about your father and your mother, where they lived, and your uncles and aunts, cousins, would that be enough? Or they don't have a form that you fill that you could get to fill in, do they?
I'm not too sure, Harry, but I can soon find out for you. It's quite easy to find out for you. I can find out if there is a form. It'll be no problem for me to pick one up for you and send it across, and you could fill in all the necessary details, or I can make inquiries what's required, and let you know, and you could take it further from there, Harry.
Yeah, well, okay, if you talk to him, why, I could, if you could talk to him and get a form that I could get, then I could send it to you. I could send it to you, if you're going to talk to him soon, fill it in and send it to you, and maybe you could hand it in around there if you're going to be in that area. What do you think, Roy?
We leave here for the States on the 1st of April, but I'll be leaving my location here, Mount Larkham, about the 29th of this month, so we're looking at about 23 days. But what I'll do, Harry, I'll tie with you up before then, I'll get on to Mel in the meantime and ask him if he can let me know, if he can give him a ring and find out, and if he can find out exactly what's required, I'll get you to give me the information, if you like, over out. That'll be, say, your parents and your grandparents, and any other relevant information they require. And I can then go to Somerset House or St. Catherine's House, whatever it's called now, and hand that information in and ask them if they can run a check for you, possibly get the information and post it across to you, Harry. How's that sound?
Well, that would be great. That would be great. I really would appreciate that. I should have done that before I went over there in 85. But that would be wonderful. Let me give you my address here, so you have it there. Let me give you my address. So you want to... Scenic Drive. S-C-E-N-I-C. Scenic Drive. Whitehall, like in London. Whitehall, one word. Michigan, of course. 49461.
zip code 49461. Absolutely perfect. Absolutely perfect. And incidentally, I was christened Henry, although I've always used the name Harry, and so was my father. His name was Henry too.
But he always
used the name Harry, as I did, as quite often is used in England, as you know. And incidentally, my mother came from Crisp Street.
When you said Crisp Street, her father had a bicycle shop there.
He had a bicycle shop, and I found it. When I was back in London, I found the old shop there. And I was surprised, and you could see under the plate, under the old plate, you could see it said the bicycle shop, and they lived upstairs. And I'm pretty sure it was on Crisp Street, and they lived upstairs, and the bicycle shop was downstairs. Oh, an umbrella shop, not a bicycle, umbrella shop. He made umbrellas. He and his wife made umbrellas, and it was a bicycle shop. There had been a bicycle shop after that, but it was an umbrella shop. And I'm trying to think. Her name was Phillips. My mother's name was, maiden name was Phillips. 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 Jeanette Phillips. And they lived upstairs in this shop. But I found the old shop, which was burnt out. Nobody was in it.
And it was, during the war, after the war.
World War II, of course. And I could see it was a bicycle shop, because the thing that stood out was the word tire, which we spelled T-I-R-E, and it was T-Y-R-E, high, over.
I think I can dimly remember a cycle shop down in Crisp Street.
We left the UK around about 75,
and in the time that I was in the UK, I'd say about 17 and a half years, I'm told, and of course I was always in that area, based in that area virtually. The actual company, Stone Manganese Marine, was at Charlton, Anchor and Hope Lane. That was where they were, Anchor and Hope Lane at Charlton. So if you went over to Greenwich and you kept driving along the side of the river, you came out, eventually you came sort of to Charlton, and then just a bit further on, you came out to Plumstead. And that was the other side of the ferry, the Woolwich Ferry. That ran from North Woolwich, as it was termed, North Woolwich across to Woolwich or Plumstead on the other side. And just a bit further back towards London from that, on that south side of the river, was Charlton, where Stone Manganese Marine was. And as I say, I used to be mostly around the London Dock area, unless, of course, I was travelling overseas to any emergency that was involved. But used to spend a lot of time around that area, actually, Harry, because I used to love the old area, because to me, East India Dock was where you used to get the East Indiaman, the tea clippers used to go in and out of there. And that had a great attraction for me, East India Dock. Most of the ships that went into there at that time, when I'm talking about, was the old British India steam navigation ships. And they used to be named like sort of Gull, Heron, all names of sort of seabirds they used to use. And also used to get a lot of these little Dutch coasters and that in there. Dutch and German coasters used to get into East India Dock. This would have been in the early part of the 60s, sort of late 50s, early part of 60s type of thing. And what I was very interested in, of course, was the fact that where the Brunswick Wharf Power Station was built, that was more or less for the side of Blackwall Tunnel. On part of the land that used to be the East India Dock, it was all filled in. It was sort of two docks combined in one large dock there, East India Dock. It wasn't a big dock at all, not by standards of Millwall or the Royal Albert Vic Dock and Jules Dock. But the East India Dock was a very historic one for the reason of the fact that it was where the tea clippers used to run in and out of. And that was where the two clippers, the Ariel and the Taping, had their race from Australia to England, trying to see who could be first at the Thames to pick up a tug to get into the East India Dock for the sale of their tea. Obviously, the first clipper that got in
got the highest price for their tea. So, as I say, I was very interested. I used to love getting into the East Indian Dock and just having a browse around the old dock area, around the warehouse and that were there. But the thing that mostly intrigued me was the fact that round the back, right on the river's edge, was a monument there to the Mayflower. The actual Pilgrim Fathers left from Poplar. The actual Mayflower sailed from Poplar to Plymouth, where it took on most of the old Pilgrim Fathers. I don't know whether you knew that at all, Harry, but it's an actual fact. There is a monument on the dock side, well, it used to be a monument on the dock side, just virtually the side of Brunswick Wharf Power Station, to say that that was the quay where the Mayflower had tied up prior to its travel to Plymouth to pick up the Pilgrim Fathers and then on to the States. So it's quite a historic area there. So you can say actually that the Mayflower sailed from Poplar, from more or less the East India Dock to Plymouth, then hence on to New Plymouth in the States. So, also another thing there, the Brunswick Wharf Power Station was built on what used to be, there used to be a couple of sort of old prison hulks there. It was the old sort of man of war, where they used to put the convicts in prior to transportation to the colonies. And also, a part of the actual dock was built more or less on what had been an old sort of prison there for convicts, and the transportation cells, Harry, were below the river level. They was down in these cold, dank, wet cells below all these big granite walls, and these cells were down below, and they became actually the pump house, one of the pump houses for the Brunswick Wharf Power Station, pumping the Thames River water through to the boilers for the turbines, for the generators, steam turbines for the alternators, to drive the alternators. Well, when the power station was opened, evidently no one would work down in that pump house after dark. And the story goes that there was one old chap, like a sort of a watchman there, and he used to go his travels with his little, he had a little fox terrier type of dog, and he never used to go down that pump house, as I say, after about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the evening. And this particular night, for some reason, he went down there, and in the morning they couldn't find the old chap, so they decided to go and have a look for him, and someone thought of looking down the pump house. When they opened the door that led down to the pump house, these big old stone steps leading down, the terrier came out of there howling, and that was the last I've ever seen of the terrier. It just disappeared, it just run off. And they found the old chap down below. He died of fright, his heart had burst, Emily, and he was absolutely terror-stricken. And what had happened, no one ever knew, but I had the misfortune to be sort of loaned out to one of the companies that were working on the power station because of the hydraulic systems involved. The company had actually supplied some hydraulic equipment for the actual power station. They were more or less controllers down in the pump house, and I went down and check it out, and I'm afraid that it certainly affected me down there. The story was that there used to be a very, very masochistic and sadistic wardress and a couple of warders that used to look after the prisoners down there, and it wasn't unusual for them to more sort of starve and beat these convicts to death. That was their usual thing. They was grossly ill-treating them. Obviously they was being paid for food from them. They used to starve them and make as much as they could on the side. Well, actually one night, for some reason, prior to being transported, some of the prisoners escaped and let some others go, and the warder, the particular warder, the chief warder, and this wardress, and this other warder, these three particularly nasty specimens, were actually torn to pieces by hand. They was actually ripped to pieces by the prisoners. They literally tried to with their bare hands, and they reckon that
that was what was the problem down there. But
you can talk to the guards and the gate of the power station, that security there, and nothing's mentioned at all about it. It's kept very, very quiet. It's one of those nasty things they like to shut away and forget all about. But no one ever goes down that pump house after dusk. From about 9 o'clock in the evening, that pump house is more or less locked up till about 8 o'clock in the morning. And if something breaks down, there's always backup systems and so forth. And I believe that not long after about 1975, 76, they did actually install a complete new pump house at more or less at the level of the just above the water level, so they was actually stuck in over the wall into the pump house instead of being down below the level like the old cells used to be. And I must admit, Harry, it was a very, very uneasy place to be. I only went down there once at about 11 o'clock one evening, and to me, I'm very, very sensitive in that respect, very sensitive, you might say, to the point of, well, I can sense a place. If I go in somewhere and something's happened there, I know immediately. It's something in my build-up. And this place, I'm not ashamed to admit it, I was absolutely terrified. I was completely, utterly, I couldn't move a muscle. I had that feeling that someone was standing right on the side of me. I could almost feel the fingers touching my shoulder, but I wouldn't turn around. There's no way in the world. I'd done what I had to do. I grabbed my tools, the toolbox I had with me, and I kept my eyes diverted. I had them down to the ground, and I came up out of them stairs about three at a time, and I'm not ashamed to admit, Harry, I had skid marks. I actually had skid marks on the underjocks, and that's quite a bit for me to admit to, but mate, I've never been so terrified in my whole life, and never again would I dare go near that place. And I made it quite plain to the company that on no circumstances would I be loaned out in any emergency to go and check that equipment. That's the story there, Harry. Enough out of me, back to you.